respondent, and 5 minutes for appellant afterward for rebuttal, if you so choose. We do have set up, and please feel free to be seated. We do have a microphone set up. You can either use the ones right next to you. There's also one in the middle. The one in the middle, you can lower and raise to your comfort, and there's also a timer on that one to make it easier so you can see how much time you have left to make sure that you stay within time. With that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready, you may approach the podium. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing, and you may begin.
And to move it up and down.
Yeah, there should be a button just underneath there. There you go.
May it please the court, my name is Bruce Nestor, here on behalf of appellant Sarah Jane Olson. The problems that the state of Minnesota and law enforcement have in meeting its burden of proof in this case are solely of their own making. On November 4th, 2020, law enforcement chose to engage in an encirclement or kettling technique to take together 600 some people, some of whom were in vehicles, some of whom were on a grassy area, and some of whom were undisputably on the paved roadway of a controlled access highway. But rather than individually identifying who was where, law enforcement swept them into a single group on the roadway and then proceeded to charge them based on their group membership rather than an individual identification and assessment of where that individual was located when they came into contact with law enforcement. Similarly, at trial for this matter, the state of Minnesota chose not to call the arresting officer for Ms. Olson. The only witnesses called were a Major Meager of the State Patrol, who was not even physically present at the scene of these events, but was monitoring them remotely by helicopter video, and a Lieutenant Misek, who was one individual present out of the numerous law enforcement agencies and persons present. No arresting officer, no body camera of the encounter with Ms. Olson, where she was at the moment law enforcement encountered her, and no other evidence of what Ms. Olson's individual and particular actions were on November 4th, 2020. Now the evidence...
And there were how many, approximately 600 people that were there and that were arrested?
That's somewhat... 646 people were cited.
Okay.
The aerial photographs, which are in evidence, I think they're on pages 17 and 18 of the appellant's brief. These are still photos taken from the State Patrol helicopter, show individuals, it appears that the crowd initially is much less than 600. Now, Major Meager testifies that it's very hard. Sometimes a black figure looks like one person, it must be multiple. There is testimony that once that the encirclement process took a period of time and that kind of a dance party atmosphere broke out and that other people may have joined. So at some point, by the time the encirclement was done, there were 646 people. Counsel. Where they came from at what moment is unclear.
I want to keep us on track because let's start with our standard review. There is no evidence, direct evidence, saying here is where Ms. Olson was at the time she was initially encountered by the police.
Correct.
We know that she was eventually on the pavement with this group of people, and that's where she was processed through whatever processes they were using. So this isn't a direct evidence case. It's a circumstantial evidence case. Do you agree that... I mean, it sounds like what you're arguing is, as a matter of law, the state can't have a conviction here because we have no evidence regarding, you know, Ms. Olson's location at the time the police first found her.
Yes, but only because there is other established circumstantial evidence that she could have been in locations that are inconsistent with guilt.
So you're not saying it's a matter of law. You're saying we apply the circumstantial evidence standard. Under that standard, Ms. Olson has the burden to show a reasonable hypothesis of innocence that is supported by record evidence. What is your reasonable, or what is your strongest reasonable hypothesis of innocence? As I read your brief, it felt like you had several going on.
I don't think it's Ms. Olson's burden to come forward with that reasonable hypothesis. And it is in terms of argument, is to say these are the circumstances of record, and as an advocate, I can identify circumstances inconsistent with guilt. It's still the state's burden to disprove any circumstances that are inconsistent with guilt, if those are established of record.
Wait, I'm not sure I agree with that. I mean, we have a conviction after a trial, and it's been my understanding that the defendant has a heavy burden to convince the court to overturn a conviction.
Your Honor, it was only with respect to the burden if you were trying to assess that at the trial stage or at this stage.
Okay, well, we're not at trial. Yeah. We're here on appeal.
So based on this record,
Olson have the burden to establish a reasonable hypothesis of innocence that's supported by evidence in the record, which would cause us to reverse the conviction.
Yes, and that is that we know out of that 646 people, they were there from three different ways.
Okay.
Some undisputably walked down the Cedar Avenue entrance ramp. Photographic evidence and testimony establishes that. Some were in lead vehicles. Major Meager testified there were at least four lead vehicles. People were pulled out of those vehicles by law enforcement, and those individuals were then cited for being a pedestrian on a highway. And of course, our argument is that that's not a voluntary act to be a pedestrian.
What's the third source?
And then the third is that individuals were indisputably in the grassy area on either side of the roadway within the kind of the sound barrier to sound barrier corridor that we're familiar with as being an inter- And so that gets us to the legal issue.
The legal issue then. So what's your hypothesis of innocence? Appellant Olson was in a car and taken out of a car onto the pavement. Appellant Olson was on the grass alongside of the pavement and was rounded up and brought down onto the pavement.
So it's that, Your Honor, undisputably, some of those 646 people came from the vehicles, which is inconsistent with guilt.
You need to establish a reasonable hypothesis of innocence. What's your hypothesis?
That she was, that the circumstances proven at trial only showed that she was one of the persons who could have gotten there three different ways.
But that's why then we have to ask, was the circumstantial evidence sufficient to prove beyond a reasonable doubt
that she came,
walked on the pavement of her own volition?
That's right.
Okay.
In the
but,
district
but
court.
But your burden here to this court is to articulate your reasonable hypothesis of innocence with some specificity, so that we can compare it to the record evidence and see if the record evidence supports it. We don't reverse a conviction simply because, in theory, different things could have happened or based on mere conjecture. We rarely reverse a conviction. The appellant has to present a hypothesis of innocence, and we have to determine whether it's reasonable, and we do that by comparing the hypothesis to the record evidence. But my concern here is you seem to be taking a much broader approach where it's just like, well, she could have been on the grass, she could have been in a car, we don't know, we don't have any information, therefore she wins. I'm not sure that's how we apply the standard. I'm looking for her theory so I can compare it to the record to see if it's supported by the record with evidence in the record.
Well, not just
the absence of evidence or the state's failure to present other evidence.
Well, I think that goes to the problems with the district court's findings. I mean,
counsel, if I could just stop you there, because we look at this de novo for circumstantial evidence. We first look at the circumstances proved, and that's a subset, and we look at the facts in the light most favorable to the district court's decision, and then we look at whether or not that's consistent with guilt, and whether it's consistent with an alternative reasonable hypothesis other than guilt. And my understanding of the law on appeal is consistent with Judge Larkin's. I think she's articulated very well. And so what we just want to find out, what is the reasonable alternative hypothesis that you are proposing other than guilt?
That Ms. that my client got on the freeway in a mode other than voluntarily walking down the entrance.
And what is that mode?
Either by being in the grassy area or by being in the vehicle.
Okay, let's take it one at a time. What of the circumstances proved, what circumstances proved support the alternative reasonable hypothesis that she got there by a motor vehicle?
That there's undisputed testimony from the law enforcement witnesses that there were four lead vehicles, that people were taken out of those vehicles, that we don't know which of the 646 those people were, but certainly that supports a hypothesis that one of them was Ms. Olson.
That's a general statement. What circumstance proved shows that she was in one of those vehicles?
Or even that suggests she was in one of those vehicles? Because under your argument, we would say, well, all 600 people could have come out of those vehicles. We don't know, therefore no one can be convicted.
No, anyone can be convicted if the state meets its burden of proof to establish that the particular individual voluntarily got onto the freeway. Instead, what the district...
The state met its burden in this case through circumstantial evidence, and if you're seeking this court to overturn that conviction, you need to have a theory and point to the evidence that supports it. You need to do more than say, well, in theory, there were other ways that any of these people could have gotten onto the roadway, including Appellant Olson, therefore reverse the conviction.
But it works the same way. It's only in theory that she walked down the entrance ramp and on the roadway.
Well,
now, the district court...
It does work the same way, but the law favors the fact that the fact finder heard the evidence and concluded that beyond a reasonable doubt, the state of... established that she was on the pavement.
And that's where the challenges to the burden. I mean, the state concluded that the fact finder concluded that a more reasonable and more credible explanation was that she walked down the roadway. The district court never said it's unreasonable to believe she got there some other way.
Counsel, let me stop you right there. I think you're absolutely right in that. And that supports, and we defer to the district court's decision. And then when we look at it de novo on the second step of the circumstances proved analysis, we look at whether or not those circumstances support the district court's evidence, giving no deference to the fact finder. And I agree with you that I think the record, well, let me rephrase it. What you've articulated is that the record appears to support the district court's decision. What we need to look at is, even if it did support that decision, would it support an alternative reasonable hypothesis other than guilt?
Right.
Let me move to away from the car, because I really didn't see any circumstances prove that would support that. Let's go to the grassy area argument. I have a question as to, how can you reach that grassy area? You can reach it by walking on the highway, correct? From the Cedar ramp to I-94, right?
Correct. And so on page 17 and 18 of appellant's brief, where we have some of these still shots from the State Patrol helicopter, one way to reach the grassy area is just by skirting along the sound barrier, which is basically, there's a grassy area between the sound barrier and the exit ramp. And the photos clearly depict black dots that Major Meager testified were pedestrians in that area. In other words, these were people who wanted to walk along and watch the events for whatever reason, but chose not to be on the entrance ramp or the highway. The second photograph in that series is taken farther down the freeway and still shows people in the grassy area. And the third shot is taken closer to the location of arrest. You see a large mass of people on the freeway, and then you see a whole number of people up against where there's now, it's no longer a sound barrier, it's kind of a chain link fence that we would contend was in disrepair. Now, it's true that the investigator who went out there and looked at the chain link fence didn't go out there on November 4th of 2020. He went about 10 months later.
Right, so but I don't think that would be a circumstance proved, because that would not support guilt.
Well, certainly Major Meager testified that he saw people exiting the freeway, and he wasn't, and so that could be, that gives.
But he also testified he did not see anybody enter.
That's right.
Recall. And so that would be a circumstance to prove, because that would support guilt.
And you asked different ways that people could have accessed. What you do see are people in the grassy area down at that, close to that location of arrest. And Major Meager's testimony that ultimately anybody in the grassy area was encircled and brought onto the highway and placed under arrest.
I'm not sure if the record supports that. I thought the testimony was that they had asked the people on the grassy area to leave, and most of them were reporters, and the people that were asked to leave did leave.
That was Lieutenant Misek's testimony, that the individuals he encountered left when asked, mm-hmm. but he admitted that he did not encounter everyone that he saw in the grassy area. So there were other people. And then Major Meager did agree that people were encircled who were on the grassy area and were charged.
Who testified to that?
Major Meager, Your Honor, and that would be... Well, I think the state even admits that on page 34 of its brief, citing to the transcript at page 34 and 35, that people were possibly brought in from the grassy area. And that would be Major Meager's testimony. And so, and this goes back, the district court used this probabilistic language to rule out. It even talking about a more reasonable explanation admits that a reasonable explanation is that Ms. Olson was on the grass. From probability, the district court just thought that was less likely. But that really gets away from a reasonable doubt circumstance. I try to think of a different circumstance. If you had like 10 people in a ballroom and 90 people outside being told you're trespassing, and all of a sudden those 90 people flee into the ballroom and that's when they're arrested, you don't convict all 100 people of trespassing. Right? And even though that might, as a probabilistic, there's probably a 90% chance that any given person was outside.
And counsel, you're over time already, and you will have 5 minutes for
rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent, please state your name for the record and the party you are representing, and then you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Amy Tripsteiner, Assistant Minneapolis City Attorney, appearing on behalf of Respondent, State of Minnesota. The state respectfully requests that this court affirm appellant's conviction for being a pedestrian on a controlled access highway. As the court has already discussed, when evaluating circumstantial evidence, a conviction is not overturned on mere conjecture. The hypotheses that have been presented by appellant do not overcome the conviction in this case. Now moving to the grassy area, which was where you just left off, the evidence in the record and the circumstances proven are consistent with guilt. The testimony from the lieutenant was that he did encounter individuals on that grassy area. However, that most of them were media, and when he asked them to leave, they did. The aerial photographs that were entered as into the evidence show the progression of individuals as they entered onto that freeway, onto the controlled access highway. And you can see in certain portions that there are hardly any people on that grassy area, that the vast majority of those 646 people who were sighted were on the paved portion of the controlled access highway. It is not a rational hypothesis that she was on the grassy area when you look at the totality of the evidence. And even if she was, that is an area that is prohibited from being on because it's part of the controlled access highway. When we look at the statute...
Before we get to the statute,
yes,
and defining the highway, would you give us the state's position as to the merits of appellant's arguments that there's a reasonable hypothesis of innocence?
The state is of the position, Your Honor, that there is no reasonable hypothesis that has been advanced that is inconsistent with guilt. The argument that she could have been in a vehicle is conjecture. That is, there's no evidence in the record to support that she was a part of that. And it's not a rational hypothesis either. The evidence in the record is to show that at most there are 10 vehicles, in five in front and five in the back. The only rational hypothesis of having 10 vehicles on the roadway is that each of them needs a driver, so that then you'd have potentially 10 individuals who were in those vehicles. But that is not...
What about passengers?
There's no evidence in the record before the district court in this particular case that there were passengers in that vehicle. So if we're taking rational inferences from the evidence in the record, the rational inference is that each vehicle would need a driver. So we know that there are 646 people that were cited. It's not a rational hypothesis that she was one of those 10. And when we look at the burden in State v. Anderson, it's that the state needs to demonstrate that does not need to demonstrate that the circumstantial evidence excludes all inferences other than guilt. It's all reasonable inferences.
Let me ask you this. How would one of those 10 drivers assert their hypothesis of innocence in a case? So we have 10 cars, 10 drivers. Those 10 get out. They're now part of 600-plus people, and there's no direct evidence regarding who was in the car or wasn't in the car. How would the state present evidence, or how would a defendant point to a record that showed he or she was a driver of a car on appeal? I mean, what? How would you do that? I mean, are you saying that, you know what, everybody who's there gets charged, gets convicted, even though we know those 10 drivers were in their cars?
The defendant has no burden in the trial to put that forth. The burden is on the state to prove that they were a pedestrian on the controlled access highway. And I'm trying to make sure I stay to the record for this particular case. As you can imagine, we had many of them. But the evidence here is that the major had a conversation directly with Ms. Olson. And at no time did he testify that she indicated that she had been in a vehicle, or that she was protesting being cited because she had come in a vehicle or was on the grassy area.
Okay, so in another case, if a defendant were saying, here's my reasonable hypothesis of innocence, I was the driver of the car. Well, if there were evidence in the record regarding ownership of the car and it matched that defendant, you know, would that be a way to get that driver out of the way of a conviction with the 600 plus other people?
It would depend on the rest of the evidence that's in that particular record for that particular case.
But it would be something. I'm looking for something.
It would be
because
more.
Because I do have concerns about the notion that, well, we have, you know, 600 some odd people. You're saying 10 people drove there, so maybe those 10 people shouldn't be convicted. Well, how do those 10 people distinguish themselves from everybody else? Because that seems to be the argument on the other side. It's like you have no way of knowing who is where, and you need to pinpoint each of the defendants.
Right, and like I said, I'm trying to be very careful about in this record here of the fact of the efforts that the state did take outside of this record to deal with those type of identified individuals, right? But so the record that we have in this particular case is that when the major came in contact with her, she was on the freeway, she was a part of that encirclement, which was observed, you know, the group had been observed walking down onto the controlled access highway, had been encountered by law enforcement, encircled and identified.
And even though she didn't have a burden of proof at trial, obviously, that she made no statement saying I was a passenger in a car, or did she make any statements about how she got there?
There's nothing in the record about that of her making any statements objecting to her detention while she was talking to the major, and she did not testify at trial, of which she has no obligation to do so. But from the evidence that we do have in the record, it is consistent with the district court's finding her guilty.
Let's go to the grassy area part, because I have the same concern there. Is you have a number of people there, reporters, who were asked to leave, but even the testimony from the officers seemed to indicate that most of the people left, but that seems to indicate that there may have been some people still there. How, if they were there innocently, let's say they did just walk down from the grassy area adjacent to the highway and then stayed on the grassy area the whole time, let's assume for the sake of argument that they weren't then on the highway, but then they get scooped up with everybody else and get cited, and yet they're not arguably in violation of the law. How does the state prove that case, and especially if they don't have to testify?
So I understand in your hypothetical, my understanding,
well, I'm not sure it's a hypothetical, because according to the testimony here, not everybody on the grassy area left when they were asked.
And to be clear, Your Honor, the state has always been of the position that the grass here.
Let's assume for the purpose of the hypothetical that the grass is not the highway.
Yes, and that's what I was clarifying.
Yeah, and I did try to clarify that at the beginning.
So The testimony in this particular case is that Lieutenant Micek did say that it was possible that individuals were there because he was admitting that he had not encountered every single individual at that point. If this court's to find that the grassy area is not part of that, then maybe there is more concern. But what we have here is that even again, if there is people that were on that grassy area, the group number was much larger that was on there. And when you look at the progression of the photographs on there, you see that the number of people that are on the grassy area change if you look at those 8 photographs. And so the idea that someone may have been on the grassy area and then came onto the paved portion, the totality is that the circumstantial evidence is that that they were on the controlled access highway. However, I understand that was the part of the scenario, but the state is of the firm conviction that the grassy area is part of the definition as part of the controlled access highway. And may I move to the legal argument?
Before you go there, okay. I realize you do want to go there, but I want to focus still on the grassy area because opposing counsel outlined at least 3 different ways somebody could get to the grassy area. One is walking down Cedar and entering I-94. 2 is going through one of the fences or the barricade, or the walls encircling the highway. And the district court did make findings on that the district court found it unreasonable that she would have climbed the wall. The third that he's outlined, and I don't know if I recall seeing that in the brief, is that there's a grassy area you could walk and enter into that area from Cedar Avenue. And I just wanted to confirm whether or not that's consistent with your understanding of the record as well.
There is evidence in the record that an individual could go off of Cedar Avenue, walk onto the grassy area, and walk along the sound barrier. The width of the grassy area changes, as you can see on there, and turns into actually kind of a paved portion as you get closer to the 25th Avenue off-ramp. But there is evidence in the record that an individual could walk on that grassy area that's adjacent to the paved portion of the controlled access highway.
Since there is that possibility, does that mean that no one should be convicted of trespassing on the highway?
No, Your Honor, because the state is of the firm conviction that is part of the controlled access highway. It is blocked off for a reason. Minnesota Department of Transportation.
I guess more what I'm thinking is, because I'm just keep coming back to the standard of review, I think at this point we presume the conviction is sound. The burden is on appellant to show that it isn't. And to do that, appellant has to show not that in theory it's possible to have reached the payment by one of 3 other ways. She has to point to something in the record that shows she reached the payment one of those 3 ways. And I don't know that she's done that. Do you think she's done that?
No, Your Honor. The evidence is that if there were people on the grassy area, but that if those individuals were mostly media, and that when they were asked to leave, they did. And by the time law enforcement caught up with the entire group and encircled them, the probability that it is somebody was on that grassy area that wasn't media, that got cited, and that it was Ms. Olson is not a rational inference from the totality of the evidence. The totality of the evidence is that law enforcement had notice of this large group of over 600 individuals who entered on and occupied and shut down I-94. The pictures support that evidence and show how the vast majority of those individuals were on the paved portion of the controlled access highway, and that when they were encountered by law enforcement, they were encircled and individually identified, which Ms. Olson was individually identified through Exhibit 1 and through the testimony of the major, who specifically remembered her, that she was a part of this group that was on the controlled access highway.
With respect to your argument, Ms. Tripp-Steiner, does this court need to make a determination as to whether or not pedestrians are prohibited from being on this grassy area in this decision?
The court does not need to if it finds that appellant has not met her burden to that it was a rational inference that she was on the grassy area, right? As has been discussed already here today, that the hypotheses that have been submitted to the court, the state presents that they're conjecture. There is no evidence in the record that supports that those are rational hypotheses inconsistent with the guilty verdict. However, the state did provide additional briefing about the definition of what a controlled access highway is, because it has been something that's been presented in these cases, right? And when we look at what the definition of a controlled access highway is, pursuant to Minnesota Statute 169.011, Subdivision 19, it talks first about every highway, street, or roadway in respect to which the right of access of the owners or occupants of abutting lands and other persons has been acquired, and to which the owners or occupants of abutting lands and other persons have no legal right of access to or from, except at the designated points and in the manner to be determined. So when we're going to break this down, what is the abutting land to the controlled access highway that has been acquired by the Minnesota Department of Transportation? That is also the grassy area. And we know that is the Minnesota Department of Transportation through a couple different ways. One, we have evidence directly from the major that it was MnDOT that had posted and erected and maintained that sign that was there. Two, additionally, the state cites the definition about controlled access highway in 160.08 subdivision 3, because in there gives the Minnesota Department of Transportation the ability to erect separations and other ways to prevent access to the controlled access highway. And you can see that in the evidence, both direct from the testimony and from the pictures, that they erected sound barriers, that they erected the fencing. All of that is the work that Minnesota Department of Transportation did to ensure that people cannot get onto the paved portion of the controlled access highway except for in the manner and in the particular ways that it is allowed. So it would not make sense that the controlled access highway doesn't include that grassy area, because that is part of the land that Minnesota Department of Transportation acquired, maintains, controls, and accesses. The abutting land is on the other side of that sound wall and the city streets and all of that. So when we look at what is the controlled access highway, and I see I've run out of time. May I finish my...
You may conclude.
Thank you.
Briefly.
That it includes the paved portion and the grassy. The state respectfully requests that you affirm the conviction and of appellants being a pedestrian on a controlled access highway. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The state continues to advance, and the district court found Ms. Olson guilty based on a probabilistic determination based on group membership and guilt by association. I mean, the state just advanced a theory that the only way to create and establish facts inconsistent with guilt in this case would be if Ms. Olson did what she's told by everybody she doesn't have to do. Everybody prior to a criminal case is told you have the right to remain silent, and your silence won't be used against you. You don't have to volunteer to your arresting officer, "Officer, I was on the grassy area. Officer, I was in the vehicle." We know that some of those 646 people came from the vehicle. We know that some of those people came from the grassy area. The state's burden at trial is to rule out those inferences by presenting evidence. They chose not to do so. They chose not to call the arresting officer.
Okay, counsel, I hear your argument, and your complaint is about the process the state used, but at the end of the day, the state convicts the fact finder of your client's guilt, and that conviction is presumed to be valid at this point. You need to show us why we reverse it.
And
you need to be able to point to something in the record to say, well, see, this evidence indicates my client was in one of the cars. You need to be that specific, because I hear your complaints about the state's ability to prove guilt in this case based on probability and the numbers, but that's precisely what circumstantial evidence is. It's evidence that does not directly establish guilt, but it's evidence from which an inference may be made that suggests guilt. That's all that's happening here. The state is saying there's 640-odd people, there's a few people in the grass, 10 people driving cars, no evidence that she was in the car or that she was up on the grass. Therefore, it's reasonable to assume that she was one of the 620 who were on the pavement. There's nothing wrong with doing it that way, and the finder of fact was free to say, based on all the evidence I've heard, I'm not satisfied with that level of proof. But the finder of fact was satisfied, and I guess I'm satisfied looking at the record, that it could support a finding of guilt. So now the ball's in your court to say, it doesn't, here's why. And we need something other than there are all these people, you can't rely on probabilities, because that flies in the face of the notion that circumstantial evidence is just as valid as direct evidence and can support a conviction.
It is, but that circumstantial evidence has to point unerringly to guilt, not merely establish a probability of it. What if we had testimony that 332 people came from the grassy area and 332? And the district court finds a person guilty because there's a 51% chance you came down the entrance ramp.
But we don't have a record that says half the people were observed up in the grass.
So there's other circumstantial evidence. I'm not requiring the state to present direct evidence. It could present other circumstantial evidence potentially, you know.
So what are the circumstances that have been proved? And that's a subset that supports the guilty verdict. What are the circumstances proved that support a reasonable alternative hypothesis of innocence or not, of appellant not being guilty?
That we know that members of the group got there in a manner inconsistent with guilt. And there's nothing that excludes Ms. Olson from those group of people who were innocent, who got there in a manner inconsistent with guilt. So the record establishes undisputably some of those 646 people were guilty. But under the district court's process of finding, every single one of them would be found guilty, including in this case, because the district court decided that Ms. Olson was 74 years old and therefore lacked the physical ability to go over a fence or walk on the grass, absent any testimony in the record as to her physical ability. The district court didn't rule out the reasonable hypotheses inconsistent with guilt. It just found the guilty ones were more reasonable.
Let me stop you there. We are reviewing this de novo. We are reviewing this without any deference to the fact finder's determination of guilt or innocence. And that's why you actually have the opportunity to present to us what circumstances proved support a finding that she was not on the highway.
Right, and so that, I mean, it is what I've said it is that we know that some of those 646 people. So to find Ms. Olson guilty on this record would mean that the decision of this appellate court is that you can convict people based on group membership as long as it's, well, at least 50% or 60% likely that it's a more reasonable, I mean, the judge, again, his whole language in his decision isn't a reasonable doubt standard. It's this probabilistic standard like it was a civil case. This was a civil case. I agree. You know, 600-some people got on that freeway, probably down the entrance ramp. 46 didn't.
And just to be clear, what I hear you saying there, this isn't the circumstances proved argument. You're arguing that the district court applied the wrong standard.
That, but the circumstances proved at trial were hypotheses inconsistent with guilt. That some people got on the highway in a manner inconsistent with guilt, and there's nothing, circumstantial or direct, to rule Ms. Olson out as being one of those persons. And just briefly on this abutting lands matter, if I may, the state both wants to say that the grassy area is an abutting land to a controlled access highway, i.e. the roadway, and that it's part of the controlled access highway. The abutting lands is referring to everything outside the sound barrier. It's saying that those landowners don't get to access the roadway the way you do if the state comes and builds a gravel road through your farm and you have a right of access. And so I think it's very clear that the commissioner, whether they had more authority to prohibit pedestrian travel sound barrier to sound barrier, the commissioner chose not to issue that order. The commissioner issued an order, pedestrian travel is prohibited on the main roadways and entrance ramps. Thus, if the state hasn't disproved you came from the grassy area, they haven't ruled out a reasonable hypothesis inconsistent with guilt.
Thank you, counsel. Seeing there are no further questions, thank you both for your oral arguments and your briefing. We appreciate both of them. It's been very helpful to have this conversation and work through the issues. Thank you both. We will be issuing our opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe. Thank you.